So we're going to finish out our day talking about non-Hodgkin lymphoma. A lot to talk about there, particularly the evolving role of bispecifics and CAR T therapy, and quite a few new agents as well. We're happy to have from the FCS Dr. Vic Malhotra from Spring Hill, Florida, and Dr. Krish Patel from the Sarah Cannon Research Institute in Nashville, and our friend Chris Flowers from MD Anderson Cancer Center. So we're going to actually start out talking about, I just mentioned CAR T and bispecifics, and we spent 3 hours a couple weeks ago on just talking about recurrent follicular lymphoma, so in a think tank that we're about to publish. So there's a lot to talk about here and to unravel, and I'm really looking forward to see how we do that. Krish, let's talk about CAR T and bispecifics.
Great. All right. So, as Dr. Love mentioned, a lot has changed in lymphoma. So, if we just think about a decade ago or so, chemotherapy was our main tool of the trade with rituximab. And just as an example, I show you here pathways for follicular lymphoma, DLBCL didn't look too different, right? Chemotherapies, potentially the use of transplant. Things have changed substantially now. A lot of this has been driven by the development of immunotherapies, in particular CAR T-cell therapy, but also by specific antibodies, and so many, many different combinations and therapies now. So just even 10 years later, things are dramatically different. And so I'm going to focus on the two immunotherapy modalities that I think have been really responsible for this shift, CAR T-cell therapy and bispecific antibodies. Both are used quite commonly in a number of B-cell lymphomas. Just to orient you, I know you're familiar with this, but CAR T-cells use a construct to engage a target antigen, in this case, in the case of B-cell lymphoma, CD19 expressed on the lymphoma, and then a moiety to essentially activate the T-cell that leads to T-cell proliferation. On the other hand, bispecific antibodies don't require any engineering. We're activating T-cells in the patient, and we do that by using an antibody that essentially targets a tumor antigen and on the other side engages with a T-cell, typically through CD3. Both of these modalities lead to then T-cell cytotoxicity towards the tumor and then also downstream immune activation, which accounts for some of the unique side effects we see, which includes cytokine release syndrome as well as neurologic toxicity. And so in the case of CAR T-cells, we have CD19 targeting CAR T-cells. In the case of bispecific antibodies, we have CD20 targeting therapies, although we can see coming soon will be other B-cell antigen targeting both CAR Ts as well as bispecific antibodies. And so just to set the stage in large cell lymphoma, we know that in the era of chemoimmunotherapy, patients can do quite well in the front line, but unfortunately, patients who relapsed, even those who went on to get autologous stem cell transplant, typically had very poor outcomes. So less than 20 to 30% of our patients were achieving long-term cures. And this is really the setting in which CAR T-cells were first developed. So we have three trials that led to the approval of CD19 targeting CAR T-cells in third-line or later DLBCL, summarized here. And now these studies all have longer-term follow-up, and we can see this very nice plateau on both progression-free survival curves as well as overall survival curves, with roughly speaking around about 40% of patients achieving a curative outcome in the third-line setting. Recognizing that success, CAR T-cells then had been trialed in the second-line space. We have two trials that led to positive approvals in the setting of early relapse, so those patients who had DLBCL that relapsed within 12 months, or who were refractory to initial therapy. That's axi-cel and lysi-cel based on the ZUMA-7 and the TRANSFORM trials. And here again, we see very good activity of the CAR T-cells, about two-thirds of patients achieving complete responses. And long-term, that translates into, again, about 40% of patients being cured in that second-line setting, in contrast to the standard of care, which would have been platinum chemotherapy with the intent to deliver an autologous transplant, leading to just around 25% of patients having long-term survival. And so we see a substantial improvement there, and this has really shifted the paradigm in second-line DLBCL to use of CAR T-cells. I'll just briefly mention as well, for those patients who perhaps are older, frailer, would not have been candidates for autologous transplant, we do also have an approval for liso-cel in that setting based on the pilot study, similar data there in terms of long-term follow-up. We mentioned toxicity being unique in CAR T-cells. We can see cytokine release syndrome, which is this immune activation, typically happens early on within the first 2 weeks. With axi-cel, we see this occurring in almost all patients, and high-grade CRS, the type that might require a patient to be cared for in the intensive care unit, in around 6%. With liso-cel, we see this very infrequently in terms of severe CRS, and just under half of patients might have some form of CRS, which means half of our patients have none. We see similarly differences in neurologic toxicity between the two CAR T-cells, higher all grade as well as grade 3-4 with axi-cel, and lesser neurotoxicity, just around 10% with liso-cel, under 5% for severe neurotoxicity. And this really relates to the difference in construct of the two CAR T-cells, specifically the co-stimulatory domains. In terms of other adverse events, hypogammaglobulinemia is important. Infections are becoming an increasing focus of our long-term management. These are often what relates to or contributes to non-relapse mortality. And so recognizing these are immunosuppressive therapies, and we need to be aware of that. And shifting to the bispecifics, third-line relapse refractory DLBCL, we have two bispecific antibodies approved here, epcoritamab, which is given subcutaneously, and glofitamab. These agents are similarly efficacious. So if we look at progression-free survival as well as complete response rates, they're quite comparable to each other. These are single-arm studies, not direct comparisons. But they differ in terms of how we give these agents. So epcoritamab, typically given subcutaneously, with weekly dosing for a while, and then every 2 weeks, and then treatment till progression. On the other hand, glofitamab is given as a fixed duration therapy, given with an interval of every 3 weeks for a total of 12 cycles. But long term, we see similar outcomes, and especially we can see that those patients who achieve early complete responses seem to be driving the majority of the benefit. When we look at landmark PFS, about 3 years from patients who achieved a CR, we can see about half of them are maintaining those responses. This is just meant to show that the two trials enrolled comparable patient types. These were late-line large B-cell lymphoma patients, so patients are typically receiving this therapy as a fourth line. About a third of the patients had had prior CAR T-cell therapy, and the complete response rates were comparable in those patients who had had CAR T. We are now also moving bispecifics up to the second line. This study was presented this past summer. This is the STARGLO trial combining glofitamab with a backbone of gemcitabine and oxaliplatin compared to R-GemOx alone. Primary endpoint was progression-free survival. Median number of prior therapies was 1 in this study. And what we see here is the green line indicates the overall survival curve for the patients treated with glofitamab and GemOx. And so we can see a substantial widening of that those curves and a hazard ratio of 0.59. This translated to a median overall survival of just over 2 years for the Glofit GemOx arm and around 1 year for the R-GemOx arm. This is the progression-free survival curve. We're starting to maybe see a plateau on that later part of the curve. Longer-term follow-up will be needed there to help us understand if those patients are potentially cured. And we see CRS with the combination of chemo plus glofitamab, albeit at a slightly lower rate than we do with glofitamab alone. So 45% of patients with CRS, most CRS being grade 1, which is just a fever alone. I'm going to shift gears here now to mantle cell lymphoma. In mantle cell lymphoma, we also see the development of CAR T-cells and bispecifics, in particular in this setting where patients have progressed on a covalent BTK inhibitor. We know that patients progressing on covalent BTK inhibitors unfortunately have very poor outcomes, and this is the setting in which CAR T-cells have first been developed with Brexacel and Zuma-2. We can see again here complete responses achieved in 2/3 of patients. Longer term, we're not quite seeing that same curative type outcome in the PFS, but about a third of patients now approaching 5 years from Zuma-2 still progression-free and free of death. And then with more recent data for liso-cel in mantle cell lymphoma, again, similarly high overall response rates, high complete response rates. And here again, we see the distinction between the two in terms of toxicity, with CRS being prevalent in almost all patients with Brexacel, about a third of patients with Lysacel, and then notably a substantial difference in terms of neurologic toxicity with less seen in the patients treated with Lysacel. We are also seeing bispecifics developed in mantle cell lymphoma. This is data from a single agent glofitamab, meant to show here again high complete response rates. This translates into durable progression-free survival for subsets of patients. Patients who are BTK exposed do seem to do a little bit worse. And then in terms of safety here, we can also see CRS. In particular, in mantle cell lymphoma, we have to take additional precautions to try to bring down the initial CRS, giving a higher dose of priming of inotuzumab. Most CRS is grade 1, albeit in mantle cell lymphoma, we can see grade 3 CRS in just under 10%. And then rounding out in follicular lymphoma, we know that chemoimmunotherapy delivers a lot of efficacy in the frontline setting, but we also know that we get diminishing returns from it in second and progressive lines of therapy. Here, too, we have CAR T-cell therapy in follicular lymphoma in third line with AxiCell and ZUMA-5, second line or beyond in TRANSCEND, and then the ELARA trial, which is Tisagenlecleucel, third line and beyond. Very high complete response rates, very durable progression-free survival benefit, and a similar toxicity profile to what we see in other B-cell lymphomas. And then here, too, we also have bispecific antibodies, two that are approved in the third line setting, mosunetuzumab, given as an intravenous infusion and a fixed duration between 8 to 17 cycles, adapted to response. Low CRS here, 29%, grade 3 or higher in only 2% of patients. And then epcoritamab, similar to the dosing given in DLBCL, very high response rates again here in the progression-free survival, just about 50% of patients free of progression at 18 months. With some modifications in the step-up dosing, we can also bring down that CRS. And then finally, I'll just share odronextamab, another CD3, CD20 targeting bispecific antibody, has also been studied in DLBCL and FL. Not yet approved for either disease, but again, I think comparable in terms of what we see here in relationship to glofitamab and epcoritamab. So across the spectrum of B-cell lymphoma histologies, we have CAR T and bispecific therapy proving to be efficacious, and safety, I think, is really an important consideration when selecting these.
Great. So let's move on to a case. Vic, you have an 80-year-old patient. Can you talk about what happened with this patient?
Sure. A very nice 80-year-old lady, quite healthy, no significant comorbidities, presented with a stage 4 diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, had a complete response to CHOP-R, 6 cycles, but less than a year after remission, she relapsed back, initially with a lump in the breast and then other adenopathy. So my question really is, she's otherwise fit? No, she's not on much medications. Would she be a candidate for CAR T, especially Lyso, given that...
Chris, can you talk about how would you think through this case?
Sure. So we typically would think about CAR T cells as an option for really any patient, even up into their 80s. I think the oldest patient that we've treated with CAR T was 87 or 88. With follicular lymphoma, and so this patient would be someone to consider. Given the data with CRS that we've seen, Lysacel would be the more common option that we would consider for somebody in this setting.
So yeah, that gets into the issue of choice. If you have one of CAR T product, Chris, then first of all, do we have a choice nowadays commonly? And if so, how do you decide which one?
Yeah, it's a great question. We absolutely do have a choice. So in those younger patients, for example, two that are approved, one thing that we think about is safety, as Chris mentioned. In particular, there's less neurotoxicity with Lysacel, but the other is really the time to manufacture. That also varies between the two products. AxiCell return in about 14 days, Lysacel somewhere around 22 to 24 days. So I think individualizing that for each patient is really important.
Chris, what about bispecific in this patient? Hold off on CAR T.
I think that's something that could potentially be an option for a patient if you can get bispecifics approved in that setting. I think, for certain patients, we can only give curative therapy if we give it in a time-limited fashion. And so I would think about if you're going after a cure for this 80-year-old patient to think about a time-limited therapy like glofitamab in that setting. I think there are a number of options, as you'll hear in my talk, for a patient when you don't consider CAR T as an option.
What do we know, Chris, about response to CAR T after a bispecific?
Yeah, so there's less data in that setting. We know a fair amount of data, including many of the trials that Chris just recently described about the use of bispecifics after CAR-T. We have growing amounts of data for CAR-T after bispecifics, but we'll start to see some of that in real-world evidence studies that will be coming.
So Vic, you had a bunch of questions in terms of particularly the issue of CRS and ICANS and other issues with bispecifics. Right. Would you like to hear them discussed?
So we are just launching our bispecific program where we're going to do the maintenance portion. The induction ramp up will still be done at a tertiary care facility because we don't really have the best supportive care for hospitalization for those patients. So questions were in the maintenance phase, how commonly are you guys seeing CRS and ICANS?
Yeah, so with the bispecifics, it's very uncommon to see CRS after, say, the first 3 or 4 weeks. So I think that's something we recognize. Really what I think more about is the toxicity in the later phases is infections. That's often going to be more common if the patient has a fever than, say, CRS.
And that was the second follow-up question is, what is your protocol that you're doing for prophylactic antibiotics, and how are you managing the IVIG?
Chris?
Yeah, so we typically would check immunoglobulin levels. When those immunoglobulin levels are below 500, we would give IVIG in that setting and continue to follow those patients actually for at least a year out from CAR T cells, sometimes even longer where you might need to continue to give immunoglobulin.
Are you monitoring the CD4 levels for Bactrim, let's say, prophylaxis?
We typically will give Bactrim prophylaxis as well as acyclovir prophylaxis, then monitor CD4 levels as well.
Antifungals or no?
Typically not. I think there are rare settings where patients have been very heavily pretreated or had a prior fungal infection where you might think about that in a prophylactic setting, but typically not for these patients.
So, Krish, how do you decide between the two bispecifics or diffuse large B-cell? You noted in terms of EPCO being sub-Q, but then indefinite, glofitamab being, you know, like 12 cycles. How do you decide which one?
Yeah, it's a tough decision to take. I think here, my approach is often to really engage the patient. I think the time that you spend in the chair or the time that you spend in the clinic all makes a big difference to the patient. So for some, the idea of being off therapy is very appealing. I will say so there's a slight also difference in terms of the dosing schedules. So you get to a bit more of an active dose a little faster with glofitamab. So that can be an advantage for patients who are quite symptomatic.
Chris, so what about outpatient CAR-T? And also, you know, we've heard that patients need to have a family member, a, you know, friend, et cetera, to help particularly monitor for ICANS. Is that still the case?
So absolutely. There needs to be a caregiver that's involved in the process and monitoring both in the patient in the hospital, when the patient's in the hospital, and at home, particularly after the patient gets charged. Gets discharged. We're moving much more rapidly than I would have expected to outpatient management of CAR-T, particularly in the myeloma setting that we're not talking about here, where we are now routinely giving myeloma CAR-T cells, particularly with cell-to-cell in the outpatient setting. Lysocell, I think we can move, and there are some centers that have moved that to the outpatient setting. I think some of the challenges that exist there are the timing and ability to be able to get tocilizumab in the outpatient setting when that's needed, and whether or not you're willing to give prophylactic steroids as a component of that. That's something that we typically have not done, but I think many centers that are doing this in the outpatient setting will give some prophylactic steroids or give so-called steroids in the pocket, where they give the patient a dose of dexamethasone to take home with them and then to pop if they do have a fever and don't have other symptoms.
So, Chris, coming back to mantle cell, I've heard it said, I don't know if there's data to directly support this, that CAR-T and mantle cell, there's more CRS and better response. Is that true?
That is true, Neil. So we see a higher CR rate in mantle cell, but similarly, we see much higher rates of grade 3, 4 CRS and ICANS. And some of the thinking there may be that with circulating disease and marrow and spleen-involving disease, you get this much more robust T-cell expansion, which is a bit of a double-edged sword.
That kind of also leads into the issue, Chris, of bridging therapy to CAR-T. Is it true that with more bulk, more problems with CRS, et cetera, and do you use bridging therapy?
So we do use bridging therapy, particularly when there are issues with the timing and manufacture of the CAR-T or when there's significant disease bulk. There are also some provocative data that perhaps other forms of bridging therapy, like low-dose radiation, may be able to potentiate the effect of the CAR-T, manage the disease when the disease is isolated to a single spot or a single important spot, and be allow the patient to have the same kind of efficacy and maybe even better efficacy of the CAR-T.
So we're going to hear in a minute or so, Krish, from Chris, some of the new data in follicular lymphoma. But I'm curious, at least right now, how you think through the issue of, again, bispecific first, CAR-T first, and also which bispecific?
Yeah, I think for most patients, recognizing the curative potential of CAR-T, if we can overcome the access challenges that exist, that would be my preferred option. But there are a lot of access challenges that exist. And so for those patients who can't have a caregiver, but are maybe able to receive bispecific in the community, can't get a CAR-T, I think that is the next best option. But our focus is often to try to get to the CAR-T. In terms of the two bispecifics, I think here the efficacy looks very comparable, the safety looks very comparable, and I think this is a lot more decided by logistics, right? What is capable at the center you're treating at? What does the patient feel most comfortable with?
And Chris, that also leads into something that Vic was sort of alluding to, which is the role of the community-based general medical oncologists, particularly with bispecifics. Are we still in the, they need to get started in a tertiary center or something like mosunetuzumab? Can a general medical oncologist start that in their clinic?
Yeah, I think for the majority of patients, it's probably best to start in a center where they're comfortable with giving and managing the CRS component of that. Typically occurs most commonly with cycle number one, and it'd be rare for that to happen after cycle number one. So that transition can happen relatively quickly. But the real challenge is having the ability to give tocilizumab, having doses on hand and available at a moment's notice if they're needed.
Yeah, that was what I was wondering about. So, Vic, do you all have tocilizumab available?
We are going to have it. We are just ramping up. REMS programs are done, so we probably do our first patient end of this month or early April.
That's really great. I think we've covered a lot of these questions. We might come back to them, but I want to move on and hear about some of the things, other things that are happening in non-Hodgkin, a lot of stuff.
Yeah. Great. Well, thanks, Neil. And you saved the best for last with putting lymphomas at the end of the day. But hopefully all of you are staying awake because I'm going to go through a lot of data relatively quickly.
We passed the hard part.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm going to jump around from different lymphoma subtypes, both in the frontline and in the relapse setting. So I'll try and keep you along to help you to keep up. So first, I'm going to talk about the frontline setting for diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. As Chris showed you, that's the most common lymphoma subtype. We're here are the first data that really changed the standard of care in over 20 years. So as Chris showed, R-CHOP has been the standard of care therapy since 2002 when we showed evidence from the French group of R-CHOP as a benefit over R-CHOP. And now here in a randomized controlled trial, polatuzumab, the CD79B antibody-drug conjugate, replacing vincristine in the regimen with pola-R-CHP, showed a significant improvement in progression-free survival, and that changed the standard of care in late 2021. What's new about these data is Gilles Saul from our work presented the first the five-year analysis of the Polarix data that showed prolonged impact from this regimen. And these are the data from the intent to treat population. There's also been an extension population that enrolled about 100 more patients in China that confirms these benefit, where you can see that the progression-free survival of this looks identical at the five-year mark in terms of a hazard ratio of 0.73. The overall survival, there still is no difference between the two arms of the trial at this point. If anything, maybe the hazard ratio looks slightly better, and so we're going to continue to follow these patients. We'd plan to stop at this five-year analysis, but we'll follow these patients to see whether there is an overall survival benefit over time. I think because of all the things that you heard about from Krish in terms of bispecific antibodies, CAR T-cell therapies, and the things that I will talk about, it's hard to expect that you will see an overall survival benefit because there's so many things that patients can now get downstream. Now I'm going to turn to the use of polatuzumab, so the same CD79B antibody drug conjugate, but now in the relapsed setting, and these are data with additional follow-up of the original polatuzumab, bendamustine, rituximab versus bendamustine, rituximab randomized trial, where you can see with additional follow-up that the pola-BR arm maintained both the progression-free survival benefit and the overall survival benefit that was seen in our original publication, with pola-BR having an overall survival of about 12 months in the relapsed and refractory setting. There was an additional extension cohort that was performed in this study, and you can see with the extension cohort that essentially the same benefits that were seen in the randomized component were confirmed in another 100 patients that received a single-arm pola-BR.
Before you go on, just to get back to pola-R-CHP, Krish, one of the issues that's been discussed there is a benefit based on cell of origin. I'm curious if we have any update on that.
Yeah, so we see a profound impact in the non-GCB patients where there's a clear difference in terms of favoring the pola-R-CHP. I think one of the challenges of this study is the way it was defined in the study was using gene expression analysis, which is not what we do in clinical practice. So we can see some patients who are GCB by immunohistochemistry who are actually non-GCB by gene expression. So it's one of the difficulties, I think, of translating what was seen in the trial into practice.
And Chris, there's been a lot of debate about whether this should be included in clinical decision making. As we just heard, I've heard people question, you know, sometimes the actual assay itself and whether the people in the community are actually getting accurate data. Is that something that's reasonable to look at, particularly in a non-academic setting?
It is important to know, and I have fairly strong opinions about this. So the Hans algorithm that we typically use in clinical practice has about a 20% misclassification rate. And so if you were going to use that Kahn's algorithm to make the decisions about which patients you treat with pola-BR versus which patients you treat with R-CHOP, you're going to be wrong about 20% of the time. And so I think that's unacceptable for using that for making clinical decisions. And so I use the standard criteria, which are the IPI 2 through 5 for making clinical decisions, at least to now. I think we will have gene expression profile-based testing, hopefully at some point in the future. As of right now, the only place in the world that's really doing this routinely is the group in British Columbia, where they use nanostring-based gene expression profiling for everybody to decide the subtype. Unfortunately, they don't have pola-BR approved in British Columbia for use, and so they're not using it to make clinical decisions. But I'm hopeful that we will have gene expression-based profiling that would allow us to be able to make those kinds of decisions at some point in the future in the U.S.
Were you surprised that you didn't see a survival benefit?
Not really. I mean, I think, you know, when you look at all the things that we have available downstream of patients now with the bispecific antibodies, with CAR T-cell therapy, with autologous stem cell transplantation, which we don't even talk about anymore, with drugs that I'll talk about next, loncastuximab, tesirine, as well as tafasitamab, lenalidomide. There are a whole host of things that patients can get that they will still be alive after their first-line therapy. Previously, when in the R-CHOP era, when that trial was first done, patients went on to autologous stem cell transplant and had the ability to be cured with that, or they went on to salvage therapy and had very short survival after that. And so that's more likely why we saw an overall survival benefit 20 years ago when we're not seeing one now.
Really interesting. All right, how about Lonca-T?
Yeah, so when we and I will go into a whole host of other things that are now available in the relapse setting. So these are data that were presented by Paolo Caimi with an update of their trial that was published in Hematologica, looking at patient who got loncastuximab tesirine or Lonca-T, where you can see for the entire treated population that the median overall survival was quite modest, about 9.5 months. But for those patients who achieved a complete remission, that was actually not reached. And so if you get a response with this antibody-drug conjugate, it looks like both the progression-free survival and overall survival are quite meaningful. And this just shows the response rates with the duration of response. And you can see among those patients who were responders that those responses could be quite durable among those who had CR. The complete response rate was about 24%, but as I mentioned, quite durable for those complete responders in this setting. The other thing to know are the unique toxicities that are associated with loncastuximab tesirine, and peripheral edema is something you need to watch out for with this particular antibody drug conjugate. It tends to be relatively mild in grade, where about a third of patients had peripheral edema, but only about 1% of that was greater than grade 3 in terms of severity. Increased GGT is another abnormality that is often seen with this, along with the other kinds of toxicities that we see in later lines of therapy, like neutropenia and thrombocytopenia and fatigue.
Again, before you go on, just to come back to Krish, I feel like we've talked about antibody-drug conjugates a couple times since we get here, right? Like all day. Anyhow, interesting that there's one in lymphoma as well, but I am curious, Krish, about your, because I've heard different stories about loncastuximab in terms of tolerability. How does it actually play out?
Yeah, I think, as Chris mentioned, the first probably two cycles tell a lot. If we are going to see capillary leak or peripheral edema, that's usually when you see it. It is mitigated by dexamethasone. So I think patients actually tolerate it quite well, in my experience.
All right, tafamidis.
That is another one where you need to have the dexamethasone in hand so that when it occurs, the patients can take it.
You give it to take home, for them to take home. Interesting. Tafamidis.
Yes. So moving on to tafasitamab lenalidomide. So this is another CD19 targeted agent where what you see here in terms of the 3-year and final 5-year data from this trial, that the overall response rate, or best overall response rate as it was reported here, was about 58% at 5 years and a 41% complete response rate. Now, it's important to note that these patients were a little bit less heavily pretreated than the patients that you saw in the CAR-T setting in the later lines of therapy, and the patients that I described in the polatuzumab BR trial, as well as other trials. Those appear to be quite meaningful response rates. And for those patients who had responses, the duration of response or the median duration of response was not reached for responders. This just shows the safety profile of these agents. And when you look at it, the majority of the safety profile occurs predominantly around the time that both the TAFA and LEN are given. When you look at the later time periods when tafasitamab was given as a monotherapy, there was some neutropenia, but that tended to be quite mild, a little bit of anemia, a little bit thrombocytopenia, and some diarrhea. But the majority of the toxicities occur in the first 12 cycles when the combination is given, and many of those are the kinds of toxicities that we also see with lenalidomide when giving it as a single agent with neutropenia, anemia, and thrombocytopenia. Next, I'm going to switch gears to a different disease entity, and these are data that that Neil alluded to earlier, and that's the tafasitamab plus lenalidomide rituximab, or TAFA R squared versus R squared trial that was in follicular lymphoma. And so as you see here, the key inclusion criteria, these were patients with relapsed and refractory follicular lymphoma who had at least one prior line of therapy, including an anti-CD20 antibody. And patients went on to receive TAFA R squared for 12 cycles of the tafasitamab, but then could proceed with dosing from weekly to every 2 weeks in those later cycles of therapy. And this just shows the majority of the post-treatment assessments for patients who had PET assessments. And you can see that complete metabolic response occurred in 49% of those patients who had the TAFA R-squared versus those patients who received placebo R-squared. There was about 39%. In terms of the CR rates, those were also higher in the TAFA R-squared at 52% versus 40% of those patients. And this translated into a progression-free survival benefit. These data were presented as a late-breaking abstract by Lori Sen at this year's ASH meeting, and I think are provocative data for R-squared, which was approved in the relapse setting for patients with follicular lymphoma on the basis of the AUGMENT trial that John Leonard presented some years ago, showing a benefit of the R-squared regimen over single-agent rituximab. And this regimen is quite tolerable given this PFS benefit.
So before you go on, I feel like I should have a bell up here that we ring every time there's like practice changing implications here. I was mentioning this think tank we did, and Laurie Zen was there. I hadn't heard about this study. And I was like, so I'm curious, Vic, do you use R-squared as second-line therapy after BR?
Very commonly.
I asked everybody, I was like, yeah, we're doing this now. Is that right? Is that what you're doing, Chris?
Yeah, I think this will be practice changing. I think some of the challenges in follicular lymphoma, you know, as you saw, all the agents that were described there, a lot more agents that I'm not even going to talk about, is that is how do you sequence
Zanu
agents?
Obin.
Yeah. How do you sequence agents, and how do the therapies you give impact your ability to give therapies later on in later lines of therapy?
Does that mean you're concerned about the TAFA in terms of later line CAR T or?
Well, I think, you know, as things continue.
They didn't bring that up.
Yeah, no, I think as
That's
things continue. So there are some data, at least, that were presented also at the ASH meeting. Now, this is in the diffuse large B-cell setting, looking at tafasitamab and looking at immunohistochemistry in a small number of patients. So about 31 patients, they found that after tafasitamab, that 30 of those patients still had CD19 by IHC afterwards, which suggests that you might be able to retain the CD19 and still be able to get CAR T after tafasitamab, and that may not have much impact. Now, I think with diseases being different and with timing being different, we need to see what that will look like in follicular lymphoma.
Interesting. But Krish, what about tolerability of this TAFA R squared?
Yeah, I think tafasitamab is very well tolerated. So I think that's why it becomes, in my view, if you give R squared, it's very easy to give the TAFA on top of that.
Everybody wants to add stuff into R squared, right? Bispecifics, you know, whatever. Is that being looked at?
Well, absolutely. I showed you how well that was tolerated in the diffuse large B-cell setting. Likewise, these data, I didn't show you the toxicity data, but they do look to be quite favorable. And so I think this will be an agent, particularly for those patients who are getting R-squared in later lines of therapy, that absolutely needs to be thought about, and for patients who are not being considered for CAR-T after their tafasitamab. So next, I'm going to switch gears one more time to another lymphoma subset. And so this is the German mantle cell group data looking at ibrutinib and upfront immunochemotherapy and the role of autologous stem cell transplantation. And so here are shown the patients who got ibrutinib, which shows that adding ibrutinib to first-line therapy looks to be a superior for patients and looks to be of a significant benefit, such that autologous stem cell transplant may not be needed after induction therapy for patients who had that previously considered.
This is the so-called triangle study?
Yeah, so this is the triangle study. Now, the other data that have been considered, these are data from my colleague Michael Wong. They looked at the randomized control trial of bendamustine ibrutinib versus ibrutinib and showed that there was a benefit to giving ibrutinib up front compared to bendamustine rituximab alone with a 25% reduction in progression of disease or death. And you can see the PFS curves there in this randomized control trial. I think some of the questions that remain about that trial and the data that I will show you next from the next randomized control trial of BTK plus chemotherapy or the sequencing of therapy and whether giving the BTK with the chemotherapy is actually better than giving just chemotherapy itself and giving the BTK at relapse, in the relapse setting. This is the next trial from Michael Wong using a acalabrutinib plus bendamustine rituximab. So a second generation BTK inhibitor with really essentially the same trial design in the ECHO trial. And you see here, bendamustine rituximab was followed by maintenance rituximab given every two cycles for 2 years, and acalabrutinib was combined in that regimen in the randomized trial. And here again, you see a progression-free survival benefit for the group that received acalabrutinib, bendamustine rituximab. But at least in my mind, the same question exists about whether if you got just bendamustine rituximab up front, whether there are benefits to getting the BTK as a single agent in the second line. When you look at the adverse events of interest in the randomized portion of the trial, atrial fibrillation appears to be reasonably similar across the two arms, particularly with the acalabrutinib where we see much less of that. The hypertension likewise also seemed to be similar. And the major bleeding was similar, and if anything, maybe a little bit lower in the group that received acalabrutinib in this setting. I think the other thing, though, that's important to note is the impact of COVID-19-related AEs, and that was higher in the group that received acalabrutinib bendamustine and rituximab owing to the suppression of B cells in this setting. That was even higher in terms of the grade 3 and greater events, with 20% versus 17% in the group that received placebo. And there were more deaths, at least numerically, in that group at 9% versus about 7% in the group that received placebo. So I think, you know, with COVID-19 being a concern for patients, it's less of a concern now than it was during the period of this trial. But I think that's an important consideration anytime you're suppressing B cells.
Although, you know, I haven't seen a whole lot about BTK causing problems in terms of COVID sensitivity in general. Have you?
Yeah, I think here it's the combination with bendamustine and with rituximab, and the fact that you were getting rituximab maintenance in both arms of the clinical trial that raises the concern about the continuous B cell suppression that was occurring over this period of time.
So you know Michael Wong's one of my favorite people to do CME programs with, and you said, do we really need the ACALA? Can we just use the BR? And I think what he's saying is, do we need the B?
Yes.
Do we need chemo?
Here's the trial that justifies that finally. So, you know, this, I think, is the next trial that that may be practice changing in terms of mantle cell lymphoma. It doesn't change practice at MD Anderson, because we've been giving upfront BTK inhibitors without chemotherapy for years. But this is the randomized controlled data that looks in untreated mantle cell patients at ibrutinib rituximab followed by maintenance versus giving chemoimmunotherapy up front. And you can see here in 397 patients that went on that were randomized with a median follow-up of now close to 4 years, that the progression-free survival was superior for the group that received ibrutinib rituximab to our chemotherapy. And the next trial that I'll talk about is a trial from Pritesh Jain that is the extended follow-up of the kinds of trials that we've been doing in this setting for a number of years. This was a trial of ibrutinib rituximab was named as elderly mantle cell lymphoma. What it really means is, for patients over the age of 70, elderly in our clinic practice is anybody who is older than the oldest clinician in our practice, which right now is in the 80s. This trial maybe not be the most appropriate name for our clinical practice, but you can see here with the single arm that looks to be quite favorable in terms of frontline ibrutinib rituximab for older patients with mantle cell lymphoma with a long median follow-up, similar to what you just saw from the enriched trial. And the overall response rate and CR rates were quite high in this study. The next trial that we've now moved on to second generation, and Pritesh Jain presented this at this year's ASH meeting, looking at older individuals with mantle cell lymphoma using frontline acalabrutinib and rituximab as the frontline regimen. And you can see here the CR rate was also quite high in this trial, with a CR rate of 74% in this study. Among the best response with additional follow-up, the CR rate jumped up to 92%, with minimal residual disease being negative in 60% of patients who were tested. So the next study that I'll mention toward the end is this study from Manita Kumar that was presented this year at the ASH meeting, which is another very provocative trial for patients receiving chemotherapy-free regimen. This is a combination of zanubrutinib plus venetoclax plus obinutuzumab, where the obinutuzumab was given up to 8 cycles and the venetoclax was started at cycle number 3. This trial at the start was given for patients who had TP53 mutation, which is the highest risk patient population, a patient population where I don't think chemotherapy is an appropriate approach to first-line therapy. But I think, as we've seen good responses in this study with a CR rate of 88% in a difficult-to-treat patient population, we'll see that this regimen is likely to expand to other areas in mantle cell lymphoma in the first line.
So just I want to hear about Vic's case of a 72-year-old, but just to finish up a couple other things about mantle cell, you didn't say too much about pirtobrutinib. Where do you see that heading?
Yeah, so yet another component in our armamentarium of agents. So typically after the second generation BTK inhibitors when there's relapse is when we've considered pirtobrutinib in clinical practice as part of standard of care. We're now moving that up into earlier lines of therapy and even some of our first line trials in the next generation of those trials that I just presented will include pirtobrutinib. And that's our new elderly trial.
So, Krish, we talked about the Triangle trial, looking at the younger patients eligible for transplant or intensive chemotherapy up front in mantle cell, and the question of, you know, do you need to do that anymore? I'm curious what you're doing nowadays with the, quote, younger patients with MCL.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I mean, I think for most patients, transplant really doesn't play a role anymore based on the data that's been shown. And I think similar to what's happening in older adults, we're trying to look at more combinations of targeted therapies for younger adults as well. So when you see CR rates up in the 80s in older adults, we're hoping that that will also translate in the younger patient population.
And what about at MD Anderson? You know, at one point there was a trial where you were given a Calo and I think R, and then venetoclax in some younger patients, and then some got chemotherapy. What's going on with that?
Yeah, so that is a trial that is actually the most recent version of that trial gives no chemotherapy as the induction and goes on to CAR T-cell in that setting. This is for our high-risk patient population that's been defined by things like TP53 mutation, complex cytogenetics, and other poor risk factors.
But they're getting a Cala, Ven, and R?
R, yeah, correct.
Interesting. All right. So let's finish out with this 72-year-old challenging case.
Sure. So this gentleman, 72-year-old guy who had a open heart bypass surgery about 2 years ago, heart disease, multivessel disease, presented about a year ago with a grade 2 stage 4 follicular lymphoma. He had 6 cycles of BR, went into CR, and just 6 months later, he relapsed, but this time it was a diffuse large B-cell lymphoma with a transformation.
How did he present clinically? What happened?
So he came with B symptoms, back pain. He had retroperitoneal adenopathy initially, and this time also in relapse, he presented with the same back pain and night sweats. Yeah, so the question is, two questions. Number one, he's stable cardiac-wise. He does have a low EF, around 45%. So does that preclude him from being a candidate for CAR-T? First question. Second is, how do you factor in bendamustine as far as CAR-T? Is that considered a problem?
Krish?
Yeah, so just thinking about the presentation, it sounds like he may have had large cell at diagnosis with that very early relapse. So I think a CAR-T approach would be my favorite option. We tend to think about the interval of bendamustine exposure as ideally being less than 6 months. I think in this setting, just recognizing it is our most active agent, we would go ahead and collect him and go for that. He may need some bridging therapy, as Chris mentioned earlier, but I think CAR T-cell therapy makes sense for this patient.
What about CAR T in a patient with this cardiac history?
Yeah, I think here is where I'd look at the pilot data and lysocell. That safety profile is, I think, probably a better profile for a patient like this. And I think the key is really that cardiac disease is not unstable. Yeah. I think that's what we really worry about. If it's stable revascularized disease, EF is stable, then I think lysocell would be a good option.
We had a case earlier, I can't even remember what it was, where we were talking about, but the patient had significant renal disease. What about that in CAR-T? Chronic renal failure.
Those are patients that if it's manageable during care, not on dialysis, those are patients we would consider moving ahead with.
Yeah. Any other questions, Vic?
Yeah, I had one other interesting case I quickly want to run by the faculty. So this is a 78-year-old retired physician from Montana who was diagnosed with a high-risk, high-grade pro-lymphocytic leukemia, basically presented with abdominal pain, had massive splenomegaly, almost reminded you of CML from the years ago, and B symptoms. So he knew something was up, went to his local physician, got diagnosis, bone marrow, P53 mutated, PLL 40% pro-lymphocytes on peripheral blood. So he basically was told it's, you know, poor prognosis. So he had intended to move to Florida, saw me about a year ago, and I can tell you how I treated him, but I want to know how faculty would have treated him. So I, at that point, the data I knew is a P53 mutation, so he started on BTK with Ben, and he's been on therapy for a year with an excellent response. Spleen's almost shrunk down, I would say 70-80%, no B symptoms, excellent performance score. So questions are, is there, what would you do? Is there any other data on the horizon? We saw the data with Abino. How would you handle it?
Did you say which BTK he's on?
He's on Acala.
Yeah, so I think, you know, BPLL used to be a very poor prognosis disease. Now with the advent of BTK inhibitors, highly active in that setting, BPLL tends to be a CD20 antigen bright as yes. opposed to CLL, and so you could also include an antibody there. But I think a BTK inhibitor and venetoclax makes a lot of sense. Venetoclax alone tends to result in transient responses, so I think the combination there is a good approach.
Yeah, nothing to add to that.
All right, I think we're about done here today. We all made it today. Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So come on back tomorrow morning. We'll start all over again.